You're listening to the podcast of Village Church in Burbank, California. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org. We hope you enjoy today's message.
We talked about the role of the Bible, and what the Bible ultimately does is point us to Jesus. The Bible takes us to the person of Jesus, who is Lord, who is preeminent over all things. And so that's kind of what we focused on last week. This weekend's sermon is going to be a companion sermon to that one. I'm not going to call it part two. It's not part two, but it is a sermon that goes along with what we talked about last week. And the title of this sermon is just simply Reading the Bible in the Light of Christ. Reading the Bible in the Light of Christ. One of the things that I get asked quite a bit from time to time is people ask me, you know, is there a particular Bible reading program that I utilize? There's all kinds of ways of reading the Bible, so many different ways of encountering the scriptures and Bible reading plans and such, but people sometimes ask, is there something you use? And there is. I've explained it in detail in other contexts, so I don't want to do that at the moment, but if you want to learn more about it, just find me or email me, and I'll be glad to lead you directly to what I do. But what I do when I read the Bible in the mornings is essentially I will have a time of reading from the Old Testament, and then I read from the New Testament. And my Old Testament reading, I read the Old Testament chronologically. I don't read it in the order of the table of contents. I read the Old Testament chronologically, and I sit down, and wherever I left off, that's where I pick up, and I read for about 15 minutes or so. I find a good stopping point. And then I cross over and I read the New Testament. And the way I read the New Testament is I read it according to the Christian calendar, which is a little too complex to explain right now. Well, again, just email me. I'll be glad to explain more. So I read the New Testament for a certain length of time, for about 15 minutes. I say all that to say this. My reading from the Old Testament and my reading from the New Testament on any given day is completely random. It's not like organized where, okay, every time I read Joshua, I'm also reading Acts or something like that. It's just completely arbitrary how they're matched. And yet, even though it's arbitrary, frequently, whenever I read my Old Testament reading and my New Testament reading for the day, sometimes there are really interesting, really cool correlations that help me to make some connections, help me to see things that I otherwise probably wouldn't have even thought about. And so this happened to me not long ago, actually, pretty recently. And when it happened to me, I said, you know what? This would make a great case study for Village Church on a weekend like today. So that's what I want to do. And at the beginning of this sermon, what we'll do is I'm going to read two separate readings. First of all, I'm going to read a passage from the Old Testament book of Numbers 15. And then I'm going to read a second passage from the New Testament Gospel of John. And I'll just read them back to back, and then we'll talk a little bit about them. But first of all, let's go ahead and read from Numbers 15. And we'll just read a few verses here from verse 32. When the Israelites were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. Those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses, Aaron, and the whole congregation. They put him in custody because it was not clear what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, "The man shall be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him outside the camp." The whole congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. All right. That's our first reading. Now, I want us to read from John 5, and let me just set it up, because it's a very long story. Let me just kind of, rather than read the whole thing, let me set it up first. So what's going to happen here is Jesus enters into Jerusalem through the Sheep Gate, right there on the northern edge of the Temple Mount, and then he takes a right, and he's there at the Pool of Bethesda. And the Pool of Bethesda in Jerusalem, at that time, there was a lot of people who bought into this superstition that the Pool of Bethesda had healing properties. And so at any given day, at any given moment of the day, there would be tons of sick people that would be lined around the perimeter of the Pool of Bethesda. Jesus goes to the Pool of Bethesda, and he walks up to a guy, just one particular guy. I mean, there's tons of people. He walks up to one guy and says, "Sir, would you like to be made well?" Now, this guy, we're told, has been paralyzed for 38 years. Jesus says, "Do you want to be made well?" The guy said, "I'd love to, but I can't get into the water." Let's pick it up here in verse 8. Jesus said to him, "Stand up, take up your mat, and walk." At once the man was made well, and he took up his mat and began to walk. Now that day was a Sabbath. So the Jews said to the man who had been cured, "It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your mat." But he answered them, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Take up your mat and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take it up and walk'?" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had disappeared in the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you have been made well. Do not sin anymore, so that nothing worse happens to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. Therefore, the Jews started persecuting Jesus because he was doing such things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered, "My Father is still working, and I also am working." For this reason, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he was not only breaking the Sabbath, but was also calling God his own Father, therefore making himself equal to God. All right. Let's look at these two stories. First story. The first story, it occurs during the wilderness years of Israel. They had previously been enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. And God, through Moses, delivers his people out of slavery in Egypt. And now they begin their long journey towards the promised land. But in between Egypt and the promised land is this massive wilderness, this desert, where they wander around for an entire generation, for 40 years. But after God delivered them out of slavery in Egypt, one of the first things that happens is they gather at the base of Mount Sinai. And Moses ascends Mount Sinai, and they're on top of the mountain. God gives Moses, and thereby gives to Israel, the law, a code of laws which was meant to begin forming them and shaping them into a properly just and properly worshiping people. And the foundation of the law is the Ten Commandments. And right at the center of the Ten Commandments is this all-important commandment where God tells the people, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what's going on with this Sabbath practice. Why did God give the Sabbath rhythm to these people? Well, remember, for 400 years when they were enslaved in Egypt, they were conscripted as this, basically a labor force. And they worked all day long, every day, making bricks. Every day of the week. They worked 7 days a week, nonstop. If you work 7 days a week, you might as well not even call it 7 days. You might just call it work. Your whole life is work. There's no reset button. There's no rest. And so they work nonstop their entire lives. So their whole identity is formed by work. And their sense of self-worth has been tied to how many bricks a day can you produce. So they have been trained to see themselves primarily as workers and producers. And they cannot seem to think otherwise. They cannot break out of that. And so when God delivers them out of slavery and they come to the base of Mount Sinai and God begins to form them and shape them into a completely different people who think differently about themselves, in order to do that, in order to aid the process, he gives them this Sabbath rhythm. He says, remember this rhythm. Every 7 days, on the seventh day, we would call it from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown, for that 24-hour period, you're going to rest from work. You're not going to produce anything. You're not going to work. It's going to be a day of worship. And what's going to happen is, over time, it's going to begin to form them to think, you know what, my identity is not a slave or a worker, and my worth is not tied to what I produce. My identity is that I'm a child of God who's been delivered out of slavery, and I am not a producer. I am fundamentally a worshiper. And that's where my worth and value comes from. So it really was this beautiful, life-producing gift that God gave to this people. But the Sabbath on its own could be kind of vague and nebulous. How do we practice this? Like, let's get practical. What do we do? Like, what is it that constitutes work? We need to put some definition to this. And so through Moses, some instructions were given around how to practice the Sabbath. And among these instructions are two of them in particular that are relevant for this sermon and this passage that we just read in Numbers. First of all, the people are told on the Sabbath day, you are not to carry a heavy burden. Don't carry around a heavy load. And then secondly, they're also told, don't kindle a fire on the Sabbath. Because if you think about it, fires can be a lot of work. You know, if you watch Survivor, kindling a fire is a lot of work. And it's very anxiety producing. So they're told, just don't worry about that. Make preparations the day before, but I don't want you exhausting yourself. Let's not do that. We're going to keep the Sabbath day sacred. Well, in this story here in Numbers 15, the people of Israel are camped somewhere in the wilderness, and there's a particular guy, nameless man, who wanders outside the camp, and he's gathering sticks, which is a double infraction. Because not only are you carrying a heavy load, but presumably he's going to take those sticks and use it to kindle a fire. So it's a double infraction, and he's caught. And so they take this man, put him in custody, and now they're going to bring him to Moses, who's going to render a verdict. And Moses says this man is to be stoned to death. And that's exactly what happens. The entire congregation of Israel, they take this man outside the camp, and they each one participate, and they stone this man to death. That's the first story. The second story occurs 12 to 1400 years later. One day, Jesus walks through the sheep gate into Jerusalem. By the way, in the years and decades and centuries to follow, the sheep gate will eventually come to be called St. Stephen's Gate. Anybody want to guess why? Because it was outside of that gate, tradition says, that's where Stephen was stoned just a few years later in Acts 7. Isn't that interesting? Jesus walks through the sheep gate, John wants us to know, and he takes a right, and there's the pool of Bethesda. He goes to this man who has been paralyzed for 38 years. It's the Sabbath day, and Jesus says, do you want to be made well? And the guy says, I would love to. I can't get into the water. Jesus says, stand up, take up your mat, and begin walking. And the guy, in faith, just stands up, and sure enough, he's healed, and Jesus slips into the crowd unnoticed. And so this man now is walking around carrying his mat, and eventually he happens upon some Judean Torah enthusiasts who spot this man carrying this mat, and they blow the whistle, and they say, wait a second, you're not supposed to carry a mat, it's the Sabbath day. You're a Jewish man, you should know better. Why are you carrying a load? You're not supposed to do this. And the guy says, I know, I would agree. But you see, there's some extenuating circumstances here. There was a guy who just healed me. He said, stand up, take up your mat, and walk. And when I realized I was healed, I figured maybe it's a good idea for me to do what he said. And now they're just going nuts. They're like, man, there's all kinds of Sabbath breaking taking place today in this city. First of all, this guy's walking around carrying his mat right down Main Street in Jerusalem. Secondly, apparently there's another guy going around pretending to be a doctor working to heal people. And they say to the guy, tell us his name. Who's this guy you claim healed you? And he says, I actually didn't catch his name. Well, later that day, Jesus spots this man on the Temple Mount. And he walks over to him and he says, look at you. You're healed. Isn't that fantastic? And he says, let me tell you something. Now that you're healed, you need to turn the direction of your life. You're embracing a life of sin. And if you don't change trajectories, what's going to happen to you is going to be far worse than anything paralysis could do. It's just going to naturally result in that. So you need to turn. You're walking towards the edge of a cliff. Somehow or another, this man now ascertains who it is. He figures it out. He says, I know who this is. This is that Jesus guy people have been talking about. And he does something that even to this very moment, I find very odd. I don't understand it. He essentially rats out Jesus. And he goes back to those Judean Torah enthusiasts. And he says, you know that guy that you were asking me about, that guy that healed me earlier today, you wanted to know his name? Well, I figured out who it is. I can tell you who it is. It's that guy, Jesus of Nazareth, that everybody's been talking about. And now these Judean Torah enthusiasts, now they're ready to stone Jesus, like what happened in Numbers 15 with that guy who violated the Sabbath. Now, in case you're inclined to soften this by arguing that Jesus, in fact, is not truly breaking the Sabbath, you know, by saying, you know, he's just, there's some legal technicalities getting around it, I want to call your attention to verse 18. Look at verse 18 again. For this reason, the Jews, and by the way, just as an aside, we ought to probably just say the Judeans, because everybody in the story is Jewish, including Jesus. And what John is referring to are these particular people, these Judeans who had a particular zealotry for the law that was not completely shared by the Galileans and others. So we're better off just saying Judeans because it's caused a lot of pain throughout history, the way it's worded. And really the translators would be well, I think they ought to help us out and just help us clarify that. But nevertheless, from this point on, I'm going to say Judeans, all right? For this reason, the Judeans, I'm going to translate it, the Judeans, but look at what John says. John, the narrator, is telling us this. For this reason, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, the Judeans were seeking all the more to kill him because he was not only breaking the Sabbath, but he was also calling God his own father, which he was, thereby making himself equal to God. So look at what we have here in Numbers. A guy is caught picking up sticks on the Sabbath, and he's stoned to death. In John, Jesus does the work of healing and tells the man to carry his bed on the Sabbath. That's interesting. So listen very carefully. There is a way of reading the Bible that would instruct you to stone Jesus. Don't read the Bible that way. Hello? There's a way of reading the Bible that would instruct you to stone Jesus. That's what these guys are doing, and they got a chapter and verse for it. They're just connecting the dots, A, B, C, D, E. All right, time to stone Jesus. There's a way of reading the Bible that would instruct you to stone Jesus. Don't read your Bible that way. And that's what this sermon is all about. Now, it's important to see how Jesus defends his actions. So I want us to back up just a verse or two, and then we're going to go forward. But let's look again at verse 16 and 17. Therefore, the Judeans started persecuting Jesus because he was doing such things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, my Father is still working, and I also am working. Just pause there for a moment. You see what he's doing? He's like, so they're wanting to stone him. They want to put him to death because for one thing, he's doing work on the Sabbath. And he doesn't deny it. He doesn't say, no, I'm not. What he says is, oh, you want to stone me because I'm working on the Sabbath? Well, guess what? My Father's still working. For one thing, he's called God his Father. That's not how people talked back then. So that's enough to trigger them. But he says, it's the Sabbath, but my Father's working. That's why I'm working, because I only do what I see him doing. We just looked at verse 18, so let's look at verses 19 through 21. Jesus said to them, very truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing on his own, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. The Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing, and he will show him greater works than these so that you will be astonished. Now watch this. Indeed, just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whomever he chooses. This is pretty awesome stuff here. So they're wanting to kill Jesus. They want to stone Jesus. They have biblical precedent for it. They have a chapter and verse for it. They can back it up with the Bible. And in this context of a discussion regarding killing Sabbath breakers, Jesus says, I only do what I see my Father doing, and my Father gives life to the dead. In other words, The very thing my father does is the exact opposite of what you're wanting to do right now to me. And you see what he's doing? He's backing them into a corner. He's like, listen, I know it's in the Torah. I've read it time and again. I know it's in there. I'm just trying to show you what my father's truly like. And he's putting you now in an awkward position because you got to decide whether you really believe this man or not. Whether you truly believe he is preeminent over all things. Verses 39 and 40. Jesus tells them, you search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, and it is they that testify on my behalf, yet you refuse to come to me to have life. So these would-be killers of Jesus have a problem. And how many of us would agree today that if you want to kill Jesus, you have a problem? Are we all in agreement there? If you want to kill Jesus, you have a problem. Well, these would-be killers of Jesus do have a problem. Their problem is not that they don't know the Bible. Though they know the Bible. The problem is not that they don't know the Bible. The problem is they don't know God. And that's the very thing that Jesus will say over and over again in all kinds of ways throughout the book of John. He'll say things like, you don't know God, because if you knew God, you would accept me. If you knew God, you would love me. If you knew God, you'd be thrilled with what I'm doing. If you knew God, you'd know I'm sent from God. He says it over and over again in John in all kinds of ways. The problem's not that you don't know the Bible. You know the Bible. You don't know God. Wow. So let's sum up the conundrum here. The book of Numbers tells us that Moses was instructed to kill a Sabbath breaker. And now in the context of an impulse to kill a Sabbath breaker in the name of Moses, Jesus says that his father does not kill but gives life to the dead. In the book of Numbers, a guy is stoned to death for picking up sticks on the Sabbath. In John, Jesus works on the Sabbath to heal a guy and tells him to carry his mat. And those who are most committed to the Torah, the scriptures, in response, want to kill Jesus. Do you feel the tension between these passages? How many of you feel the tension? How many of you can feel it right now? It's getting tense in this room, huh? You're supposed to feel it. John wants you to feel that tension. In fact, he's already told you from the very beginning of his gospel that he's up to no good. He's already tipped you off. At the very end of his opening poetic prologue in John 1, he's already given you a clear hint what he's trying to do. Let's look at it, verses 17 and 18 of John 1. The law indeed was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. That's an interesting statement. But then he goes on, verse 18, no one has ever seen God. It is the only Son, himself God, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. Now, if you and I, let's be honest, if we didn't already know that that's in the Bible, right there, we would throw the flag. We'd go, time out, we'd blow the whistle, and we'd say, John, you're wrong there, because I can open up my Bible, John. Are you really trying to tell me that nobody's ever seen God? And John would say, absolutely, he's not backing down. And you say, well, John, well, let's look back. What about Abraham? Abraham saw God. God came to Abraham while he was at Hebron, camped under the oak of Mamre. God came to him in the form of those three strangers and had a meal with Abraham, had a steak with him. What about Jacob? Jacob saw God at the top of that ladder in his dream at Bethel. Moses, it says, saw God face to face. And then he brought the 70 elders up with him to Sinai. And it says in the black and white, they saw God and ate and drank. And how about Isaiah? Isaiah says, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple, Isaiah 6. Ezekiel saw God. He saw visions of God by the river Kibar. John, what about all of this? And John would just stand there and look at you and say, now who's the apostle, you or me? I know the Bible. I know what's in there. You don't have to teach me the Bible. I know all of that. I know about Abraham and Jacob and Moses and the elders and Isaiah and Ezekiel. I know about all of that. I also know that the Holy Spirit told me to write this. No one has ever seen God. But the only begotten Son, who is near the Father's heart has made him known to us. So no matter what visions or dreams or revelations or epiphanies or theophanies or Christophanies that people have had in times past, compared to the revelation of God that we've received in his Son, it is as if no one has ever seen God. The Son, Jesus Christ, is the complete, full, quintessential revelation of God who outshines every other source of light. Every other source of light is subsumed in the true light of the world, Jesus Christ. It's like trying to find the Big Dipper at noon on a clear day. You're just not going to see it. It's there, hadn't gone anywhere, but you're not going to find it because all you can see is the sun shining at its full strength. That's what John's saying. So, one day a woman is caught in the act of adultery, John 8. The Torah enthusiasts have found this woman caught in the act of adultery. How they found this, I don't know. But they locate this woman, drag her to Jesus, throw her down, and they got a little conundrum, a little problem for Jesus. They say, Jesus, you know what Moses said? Moses said we should stone such a woman, and they're right. They're right. They've set it up. Moses said we should stone such a woman. What do you say? And Jesus is very deliberate, kneels down and just begins to write in the dust. We don't know what he said, what he wrote. I got my guesses, but that's for another sermon. He's writing in the dirt, and then he stands up. And he says, okay, that's what it says, so it's in the black and white. We'll go ahead and move forward. And how about we do it this way? How about the one who's without sin cast the first stone? And one by one, they all leave in shame. He forces them to think as an individual person. He dislodges them from the angry mob mentality. And they think as an individual and they walk away in shame. And now it's just Jesus standing alone with the woman. And he just looks at her and says, where are all your accusers? Does no one condemn you? And she says, no one. He says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Now, the Old Testament is the Bible of Jesus. And Jesus is a man of the Scriptures. We can't take the Old Testament and throw it out. We don't have that option as Christians because Jesus is constantly drawing upon the Old. You can't understand who Jesus is without the Old Testament. It's part of our canon. It's our Holy Scripture. It's part of it. But what is the Old Testament? The Old Testament best understood, listen very closely to this, the Old Testament is the inspired telling of Israel's story, of their journey of coming to know the true God, the self-revealing God, but ultimately that story leads them to Jesus. So you can't just stop somewhere in the Old Testament. You can't just stop and say, well, there it is, that's our bullseye. Let's go out and find some adulterers to stone and also anybody who's picking up sticks. Let's go stone them. No, you are reading one stop along Israel's long journey. God's working with these people where they are. It's complex. But you don't just stop somewhere in Numbers. You keep going until you get to Jesus, because the Old Testament is the inspired telling of Israel's journey of coming to know the true God, but ultimately the destination is the living, risen Christ. That's what I'm saying tonight. So, if it seems as though God is changing from the Old Testament to the New Testament, which he is not, I want to be clear about that. But if it seems to us that God is changing from the Old Testament to the New Testament, and let's be honest, sometimes it absolutely seems that way. If it seems that way, though, the reality is God is not changing. God is not mutating. God is not moving. We are. We're growing. We are maturing. We are coming to have a more mature perception and understanding of who God is. We're the ones on the move, not God. Now, we're educated people. We all know that the earth revolves around the sun, correct? Miss Wanda, you taught that in your classes. The earth revolves around the sun. But you know, from our perspective, it doesn't look that way, does it? It doesn't seem that way. We know better, but even like our language, some of the phrases that we use, still reflect, they're like relics from ages past. So we'll talk about sunrise and sunset. We'll say things like, oh man, the sun came up over those mountains this morning. Or wow, look how high the sun is in the air. It must be around noon. Or in the early evening, we'll say, well, there she goes. It's a very natural way for us to speak about the sun, except the sun is not moving. We are. And this is the conversation Jesus is having with these guys. He's like, listen, the reason I'm working to heal people and liberate people on the Sabbath is because I'm trying to show you what God truly is like, but you're still stuck in numbers. It's like your clock is blinking 2:30. You're stuck in time. And all you want to do is go stone adulterers and stone people picking up sticks on the Sabbath. And I'm trying to explain to you, I'm trying to reveal to you, that's not really what your God is after. That's not really what he wants. But you're stuck. You got to get moving, and I'm here to help you. So God's not changing. God's not moving. But hopefully we are. Hopefully our perception, understanding of who God is maturing, and we'll know that it's really maturing when we behold the beauty of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Because God is like Jesus. God has always been like Jesus. There's never been a time when God wasn't like Jesus. We haven't always known that, but now we do. So every morning, I read my Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, because it is the inspired witness to the living Word of God, who is Jesus Christ, preeminent over all things. Jesus is Lord.
Thank you for listening to today's message. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org.